You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of May 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
This new technology raises profound questions about who is targeted and why, about civilian casualties and the risk of creating new enemies, about the legality of such strikes under U.S. and international law.
Should governments be allowed to kill their own citizens in airstrikes if they suspect them of committing terrorist acts? Also coming up...
We've got some leaders of some fantastically corrupt countries coming to Britain. Nigeria and Afghanistan, possibly the two most corrupt countries in the world.
As you're preparing to host an anti-corruption summit, it's probably unwise to describe some of your guests as fantastically corrupt. But could the British Prime Minister's conversation with the Queen have repercussions? And we'll also ask whether Georgia's national database for singletons could hold the answer to the country's falling birth rate. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome, one and all, to Midori House. My guests today are the writer and broadcaster Stephen DL and Xenia Wickett, who's head of the US and Americas programme at Chatham House. Stephen and Xenia, welcome to you both. We'll start with this.
Today I can inform the House that in an act of self-defence and after meticulous planning, Rayard Khan was killed in a precision airstrike carried out on the 21st of August by an RAF remotely piloted aircraft while he was travelling in a vehicle in the area of Raqqa in Syria. In addition to Rayard Khan, who was the target of the strike, two ISIL associates were also killed, one of whom, Ruhul Amin, has been identified as a UK national. Mr. Speaker, we took this action because there was no alternative.
That was Prime Minister David Cameron confirming that British jihadists had been killed by their fellow countrymen in an airstrike in Syria last summer. Well, today, an influential group of politicians has said there needs to be urgent clarification on these types of attack and has even warned that pilots, officers and government ministers could face murder charges if they fail to comply with international law. Stephen DL, we'll come on to how other countries have dealt with this issue in a moment, but certainly from a British point of view, this is slightly tricky territory, isn't it? It's very new territory for governments to be trying to deal with, and Britain is still trying to work out where it stands.
It's new territory, and of course it's new technology, effectively, as well. I mean, I'm still one of those, I'm enough of a dinosaur to think, oh, a drone, yes, that's the little thing that some people use now to take photographs from the air. But of course, these are rather bigger than that, and they're rather more deadly. In one sense, I'm quite pleased about it, in so much as it shows the very British way of, you know, doing things properly. There are other countries, as you hinted, that would just say, "Well, we had to get him." You know, what's the problem? What's the question? But I think that it is right, and I'm very pleased that the British side does follow due process. Whether down the line it then gets pushed into a siding and actually we come to no definite conclusion remains to be seen. But at least the questions are being raised, and I think in the current circumstances that's only right.
Xenia Wickett, a similar debate has been taking place in the US for a little bit longer. It's thought that now up to four US citizens have been killed in drone strikes. And again, there is this issue about whether a nation state should be able to kill its own citizens.
It is. I mean, the American, on the American books, many, many decades ago, following some less than pleasant activities by various parts of the US government to assassinate various individuals who they didn't like, the ability to assassinate came off the books in America, so it was no longer legal to do that. So, you know, on the other hand, the idea of preemptively killing somebody who is planning an attack is acceptable, and as Stephen said, we now have new abilities to do it with new technologies. And if you look at, you know, generally speaking, I think a lot of people tend to perceive President Obama as being, you know, he has shut off torture as an option available to the military to find information. He much like President Bush, has tried to shut down Guantanamo. He's done a lot of things right, but what outsiders think is positive moves. On the other hand, he's also significantly increased the use of drone strikes. So to President Bush's approximately 50 times during his presidential term, Obama's already above 500. And so, you know, this is increasingly a question as to whether this is a legitimate use of power, whether you should be able to take specific individuals out through the use of drone strikes. And it's a question that we are only in policy terms, whether it's in the United Kingdom or the United States or elsewhere, belatedly coming to catch up with the legal implications now with a policy that has been implemented for the last 5 or 10 years.
But I think that, I mean, that point, you make a very good point about, you know, Bush used 50, Obama's used 500. But that says more about the technology, doesn't it? The fact that they were so very new when Bush was there, and now they are an accepted part of the arsenal of any decent army, really. So, you know, I think that's, it's not, I wouldn't point the finger so much at Obama. I'm not saying you were pointing at Obama, but I think that it's in that context as well. The technology has improved vastly.
Zane, you're on this issue then of who is being killed. Does it matter? Should we be making any distinction whatsoever between whether someone is a citizen of the nation that is doing the bombing in the first place?
It's a great question. Morally, should we? Probably not. But legally, absolutely, there is a distinction. Citizens have very, very different laws, are ruled by very different laws than foreigners are. And that's true in any country. So legally speaking, there is a different set of legal standards by which you have to treat your own citizens, due process, et cetera, than you do have to treat foreigners. But morally, it's an excellent question. And I would, you know, I would question, for example, you know, if you look at a newspaper, particularly in the United States, they will say, you know, tsunami, 10 American killed, and they will forget about the thousands of foreigners killed. I mean, we think of our own citizens in a very different way. This is not just true of America, it's true here as well. We think of, you know, we want to know how many of our citizens were affected in a terrorist attack.
And there's also the issue, isn't there, Stephen Dale, about how we now view our own citizens when they are deemed to have essentially crossed sides and become quote-unquote terrorists. So you've had discussions in France, for example, about should the state strip citizenship from people who have taken part in terrorist activities. There are debates here in the UK and in the US about people who have gone to Syria to fight for ISIS, should they be allowed to come back in?
Yeah, no, so, I mean, I agree fully that, you know, there is a difference. And the whole idea of taking out someone who you believe to be a threat to your country, I think if you had a straw poll of citizens on the street, they'd say, well, actually, that's probably the right thing to do. If I can sort of go back in history a little bit to Cold War times, one of the things that the NATO and the West were always saying, you know, no first use, we would never use nuclear weapons first. And the Russians also said no first use of nuclear weapons, but there was a rider. It was unless we think the other side's about to use them. So in that logic, you know, if you think that someone has gone abroad to be trained to perform terrorist acts and they're going to come home, then there is a certain logic that says, well, you cut off the source, you cut off at source. So, you know, I can... And if it's one of your own citizens, there is a difference.
But there's also, I mean, you have to remember that this is, so much of this is governed not just by moral authority, but by the legal, what is legally allowed. So, you know, one of the big questions taking place in the United States, clearly also taking place here in the UK, is, are we at war with ISIS? You know, certainly America went to war in Iraq, went to war against Al-Qaeda, but is ISIS sufficiently affiliated to Al-Qaeda that we can say that the legal precedent that allows us to attack ISIS still stands? That's a very big question. You can go back millennium and talk about kind of jus in bello, jus ad bello, the right, the kind of the rights that you have to go to war with somebody versus the rights that you have in terms of how you implement said war. These were concepts that were created eons ago. We have new technologies now that we have to apply to these concepts, or that we are trying desperately to apply to these concepts to find a new set of rules.
And yet, Stephen Dale, it's not just the new technology here which is an issue, isn't it? The past 15 years, there's been this hazy issue about who the West is at war with. It's been a war on terrorism, not a war with a nation state. So we saw many of the people that end up in Guantanamo were termed enemy combatants rather than necessarily prisoners of war.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, carrying on that legal argument. I mean, if we go back even just into the last century, I mean, the start of the Second World War, you know, Britain declared war on Germany on the 3rd of September 1939. There was, you know, it's almost like a document, a declaration of war. Nowadays, the other side, I mean, Daesh, ISIS don't declare war as such. They don't sign any document and say we're now at war with the West. It's just known that they are, the way they behave. You know, do we have to therefore declare war on them, or is it clear? I mean, as I say, I'm not a lawyer, so the legal issue is perhaps a cloudy one.
But it's also going to get more complicated, not just about declaring war against a group, but also against states. So you can make an argument that the United States and Israel allegedly, in sending a cyber attack against Iranian nuclear facilities, declared war on Iran. You can make that argument. Because they allegedly attacked Iran with a through a cyber attack. Was that war? Was that not war? This is the idea of declaring war is frankly in today's world much, much harder to judge, because it isn't a question of troops on the ground, which is historically. It is a question of cyber. It's a question of economic war. It is a question of war against individuals rather than states. All of this is changing.
Stephen, just to pull this back to the original question about whether... I'm quite happy we moved on to where we did, but just to wrap this up. When we look at this issue of whether a state can essentially assassinate one of its own citizens, or kill, to put it in a less sort of colourful language, do you think that nation states, particularly the UK and the US, might look to try to codify in some way whether this is actually should be allowed?
I think they're going to have to. I think, as we've been saying, this whole legal question, because of the new technology, because of the new type of war, because of cyber and so on, it's all changed so much, so rapidly, that I think that there has to be something to say that, you know, if a country has just cause to believe that an individual or a group is a threat to them, then they are allowed to carry out these actions. I mean, if my words sound woolly, it's because it is still woolly, and I don't know how, you know, it's going to keep the lawyers very busy for a long time, I'm sure.
Okay, we'll move on. Austria's political crisis deepened yesterday when the country's Chancellor, Werner Faymann, resigned after losing the support of his own party. Many Social Democrats blame Herr Faymann for not doing enough to counter the threat of political extremism in the country, with the far-right Freedom Party candidate Norbert Hofer winning the first round of Austria's presidential election a fortnight ago. To make matters worse, the Social Democrats and the centre-right People's Party, who've both dominated the country's political landscape since 1945, didn't even make the country's presidential runoff, which will take place in a fortnight's time, or just under a fortnight's time. Stephen Dale, this is a tricky time for Austrian politics, he says carefully. Is this a reflection on what's happening broadly across politics and the fact that the populists are fairly popular? Or is there also something specifically Austrian about this?
I think, I mean, I'm not a specialist on Austria, but I think there is an element, and Austria has a, if you look back in its history, it's got a bit of a dark history. But I see it more as a Europe-wide phenomenon, that far-right parties, extremist parties, are getting traction. But, and I think there is an important but here, I think it's very easy to get very worked up about this. I think this is less, though, a question of people becoming much more right-wing. I think it's a question of fear. And the reason I say that is, if you look back, last week, here in London, we had an election for a mayor. There were three candidates standing out of 10 who I would describe as pretty extreme. I'd take out the pretty, actually. They were extreme. They did very, very poorly, I'm delighted to say. And what happened, more than 1 million people voted for a Muslim of Pakistani origin who is now the mayor of London. If you live in a multi-ethnic, multicultural society, as London is, and you can't get much more multicultural and multi-ethnic than London, and so you actually associate with people and you understand them better, you've got a better chance of getting on. If you live in smaller communities where all you see are the headlines, you hear the raving politicians saying, oh, you know, extremism, immigration and so on, it's out of fear and ignorance that these votes happen. And I think there's a strong element of that here.
But it's more than fear and ignorance. It's also, for all the winners, there are also losers. And we tend to forget about the losers. So, you know, globalization, you know, I follow the United States very, very closely. You've got the people who are voting for Donald Trump and who are voting for Bernie Sanders are the people who are disenfranchised, the people who've been left behind, even while America has gone back to decent levels, you know, to 2.5% growth. That's happening in Europe too. It's not just about fear. It's also about the fact that some people are losing out while others are being able to learn new skills, to develop, to take advantage of the growth in states. And so, and we've tend to have forgotten those people. We haven't found a way to bring them into the system, to re-educate, if that's what it's, retrain, to actually give them new opportunities so they aren't feeling threatened by refugees, they aren't feeling threatened by competition internationally.
There is a broader issue here, isn't there, Stephen, that over the last 15 years, when globalisation has really taken root across, certainly across Europe, is that those politicians in the centre, on the whole, haven't really managed to find either a narrative or even, you know, actual support for many of those people who, as Zania says, have now been left behind.
Yeah, that's true. That it's those, I suppose, those who shout loudest get noticed the most. And, you know, in Britain, we've had the rise of UKIP, the UK Independence Party, who have actually made quite a noise, have certainly been noticed, but again, didn't do terribly well last year in, that's putting it mildly, in our parliamentary elections. I'm interested to hear what Zania said about the situation in the States, and I must admit I hadn't considered the disenfranchised element, but because it strikes me that an awful lot of people in, particularly in the middle of the United States, actually see the world as flat and not going outside the middle of the United States, and that New York and Los Angeles are on other planets. And when we see some of the politicians who have been elected in the United States, it worries me. Going back in recent years, it worries me. I can see the disenfranchised argument as well, but I still think, you know, that a lack of education, ignorance, and fear of the unknown. I think it's something that drives us a great deal. That anything we don't quite understand tends to frighten us.
Zania, is there an Austrian angle to this as well? In that this is a nation that didn't have an immediate reckoning with its history during the Second World War, post-Second World War. It also had, you know, yes, okay, it's been dominated on the whole by centrist politicians, but had Jörg Haider and the Freedom Party back around the turn of the millennium. Before that, they had the Kurt Waldheim affair, when Kurt Waldheim became president of Austria and it was revealed he'd been less clear than he perhaps should have been about his what he was up to during the Second World War. Is there an argument here that Austria needs to have a bit more of a reckoning with its past?
There may be an argument that Austria needs to have a reckoning with its past, but I don't think that that's what's causing this. I mean, if you look across Europe, whether you're sitting in Germany, where they have had a reckoning with their past, or you're sitting in some of the Baltics, you're sitting in Hungary, everybody is finding it extraordinarily difficult to find the right balance between accepting the huge influx of refugees that are coming from the Middle East and Asia and elsewhere, and also continuing to provide for their own citizens. And in fact, in some respects, we're almost flipping back to the first story, because the question is, what are the obligations you have to your own citizens, and how are they different from the obligations that you have to a foreigner? And for most people, they will say that my state has more obligations to me than they do to a foreigner. That is exactly the problem that Feynman is having to deal with and has come a cropper under. So whether they have to deal with their history or not, I think, is a valid question, but that is not the problem in this case.
Okay, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Zanya Wickett and Stephen Diel are my guests. Coming up, could a radical plan to put Georgia's single people on a national database help avert a demographic crisis? But first, this.
Evening. The Monocle Cafe is giving the age-old happy hour a special twist. Sit down for freshly made nibbles and refreshing drinks to take the edge off your day. Kick back, relax, and let us serve you from a great selection, whether your tipple is a crisp Forscht beer or a smooth Aperol spritz. We're putting the happy back into happy hour. Join us at the Monocle Cafe in London's Chiltern Street every day from 1730 to 1900 and until 2000 on Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Cheers.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Take a listen to this.
We had a very successful cabinet meeting this morning. We were talking about our anti-corruption summit. We've got the Nigerians. Actually, we've got some leaders of some fantastically corrupt countries coming to Britain. Nigeria and Afghanistan, possibly the two most corrupt countries in the world.
If you can't quite make it out, that's the British Prime Minister David Cameron telling the Queen and the Archbishop of Canterbury that he would be hosting some fantastically corrupt countries. He then names Nigeria and Afghanistan at his anti-corruption summit. Zanya Wickett, before we get on to the issue about whether Nigeria and Afghanistan are, as the Prime Minister puts it, fantastically corrupt, it wasn't the most sensible thing to be caught saying before you invite the world to your door, is it?
It's probably not the most, not the best thing to say. And frankly, most leaders should know better. I mean, you know, I looked up some of the best political gaffes, and they really are some corkers. Well, you know, I mean, there was a Nicolas Sarkozy and Barack Obama talking about Benjamin Netanyahu saying, in the case of Sarkozy, "I cannot stand him, he's a liar," to which Obama responded, "You're fed up with him, I have to deal with him every day." This was back in 2011. I mean, leaders should know better. The idea that you actually have microphones around you and you still say what's on the top of your head as
the
opposed to what
really
you're...
The camera was really close. I mean, it's more than a few feet away.
It's really, they should know better. And if they get caught, well, I mean, the good news is, if you want good news out of this story, is... it's probably true. I mean, this is no great surprise. The idea that Nigeria and Afghanistan are corrupt is not a surprise to anybody. You look at the Transparency International's Corruption Index. Afghanistan, I think, is 167, which is three from the bottom. Nigeria isn't a lot more. But if you want to talk about the quantity of corruption, i.e. the amount of dollars worth of oil that are stolen, then I think Nigeria is pretty much up there.
Stephen Diel, the bit we don't hear on that clip is Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, sort of countering Mr. Cameron and saying, well, actually, the leaders of these nations are actually doing their best to try and stamp out corruption. And one assumes that will be the argument that Mr. Cameron will perhaps take up when he's talking to said leaders.
Well, yes, particularly as he's got to speak to them in the next couple of days. I mean, I'm not a great one for having sympathy for politicians, but... on this occasion, I thought, well, you know, we have a go at our politicians enough for saying, you know, oh, they're fooling us, they're not telling the truth. Let's be not too harsh on them for telling the truth. because as they are, as Senior's just said, Afghanistan, 167, according to Transparency International, only Somalia and North Korea come lower in the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index. But it does, I think that the surprising thing is, you know, why come out with something like that? You know, there was no need to. He was at a celebration for the Queen's 90th birthday, talking to Her Majesty the Queen. He meets the Queen once a week. This is the British system, that the Prime Minister meets the Queen once a week for private discussions, and the content of those discussions is never revealed, but never.
No cameras around then.
No.
Zanya, it reminded me, actually, of, as you say, the thing about Sarkozy and Obama, the famous thing between George W. Bush and Tony Blair, which got referred to as the Yo Blair incident.
Yes, there was a Yo Blair incident. It actually got even worse than Yo Blair. And I was recalling President Bush massaging Chancellor Merkel's shoulders at one point in one G8, which didn't go down too well either. But, I mean, I think, you know, to be fair, to be a little bit more serious, the Archbishop of Canterbury does make a very valid point, which is, you know, countries are corrupt. Individuals are corrupt, but not all individuals are corrupt. And so, you know, you have Buhari, the new leader of Nigeria, who, to the extent that one can evaluate, you know, less than a year into his term, is making a lot of efforts to decrease corruption. Afghanistan, there have been huge efforts to decrease corruption. And you have to give people credit for what they are trying to do, not just for the state that they took over a country in.
Okay. Now, finally, Georgia. This is Georgia the nation, not Georgia in the US, has hatched a plan to deal with a potential national crisis that would have pleased the country's most famous son, Joseph Stalin. The Demographic Development Fund says that dating apps like Tinder aren't doing enough to speed up the former Soviet Republic's birth rate and is recommending putting all of the country's singletons on a national database. Stephen, what do you make of this?
I can see people in Georgia. I've been to Georgia a bit, and I can see them just laughing at it, but also seeing it as sort of state interference. It sounds like the sort of thing that the Soviet authorities would have done. It's more than just a census. It's trying to say, not only say, you know, so you know you're not married and you're single, and you know, and you ought to go and have children. They will just laugh and say this is state interference. I mean, yes, there is a population problem, at least, you know, the population has fallen. But I think, you know, the best way to get people to increase the population of any country is let them have normal lives.
Zainia, there's not enough detail about this yet to work out how this would
work. I'm not
sure
I want detail on this,
actually. I'm just wondering, do you get, you know, if you're, let's say you're a Georgian singleton and you're in a bar in Tbilisi and you get talking to someone and they tell you their name, can you then check online to see whether the person genuinely is single or not?
It's an excellent question. I mean, you know, I mean, what is this database? Who's going to have access to this database? You know, I mean, yep. Question number one. You know, can I Google, you know, the database saying I want blonde, 6'4", you know, male, has to weigh within, has to, you know, I mean, will you be able to do this? It strikes me that the private sector's done a pretty good job, whether it's Tinder or it's Match.com or it's things of that nature, all of which I'm assuming take place in Georgia. The idea that the state would do a better job, I'm a little bit dubious about. And if you want to increase the population, it strikes me that actually maybe you start at the other end, which is actually, can we do something about the health services? Can you do something about the quality of life of people actually being somewhat better and therefore they have a better quality of life, etc.? It strikes me that there are other ways to do it than to try and introduce singles to one another.
But it's interesting.
I say, as a married woman.
Well, I'm saying as a married man with three children, it's interesting that you talk about quality of life, because in Denmark they did something similar as well, and they tried to make it a bit quite fun. Now, you know, Denmark, the standard of living is very high. Do it for Denmark, do it for mum was a campaign which encouraged couples to go on holiday to conceive.
I'm not sure how to do it to mum for mum. Does that? It's a little bit worrying.
I agree. That's how they saw it.
Stephen, to go back to Georgia for a moment, a country that, as you say, you know, having been based in Moscow, you've been to more than a few times. How do you think people in Georgia are actually going to take this? And does the Georgian government actually have the capacity? I mean, we say it's a bit Soviet, but do they actually have the capacity to do something like this and create an actual database that would be accurate?
I don't think they do. And as I say, I think Georgians will just treat it as a joke. Some, no doubt, will be offended, but most of them, I think, will just laugh it off and just say, you know, what a load of nonsense.
Okay. Well, that's as good a note as anywhere. No, go on.
I was just going to say, it is worth noting that the population has dropped, but the birth rate is actually not really dropping anymore at all.
It's that everyone wants to leave rather than that they're not having enough
Again,
sex.
Back to quality of life.
Okay, there we are. That's a good note to end on. Zenya Wickett and Stephen DL, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. The programme was produced by Rhys James. It was researched by Fernanda Augusta Pacheco and Mary Justi. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. We've got music next, then it's Section D with Josh and Henry. The Monocle Daily at 2200 London time. Midori House back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. That's 1300 if you're living in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.